We will now move to a panel discussion where we will put questions from our audience to each of our presenters. I would like to remind our participants that you may send questions to our speakers using the chat window, and then our team will get those together for me as we go along here. Maybe I see kind of a clarifying question to start with. So maybe, Danelle, what is the name of the event that can be organized for our stakeholders? I think one of our participants missed that.
Yeah, thank you, Anna. I see that question. I'm not exactly sure which of the events we touched on that they might be referring to, but I'm going to take my best bet. I'll start with the scenario planning workshops. Those were the ones that would have brought agricultural producers, again, maybe the beef feedlot operators or the crop farmers. That was the name of that event that brought them together to talk through the different extreme weather scenarios and create some fun graphics to depict it. So that was the scenario planning workshops. If you were referring to the last thing that I presented, kind of that brought USDA and Extension together in the same room to kind of reunite and get to know each other again, we just called that the USDA and Extension Climate Training. And then finally, we talked quite a bit about the Agro Climate Outreach Exchange for bringing together outreach professionals to talk about agriculture and climate. So just depending on who your stakeholders are, those were the three I thought you may have been referring to.
Perfect. Great. And I guess if there was another event or follow-up question to that, I'd invite that person to kind of put it back in the chat and we'll follow up with Danelle. One question to kind of kick us off here, though. Danelle, what tips would you offer a newer extension or outreach professional who might feel a bit nervous about talking about climate change with their agricultural stakeholders?
Yeah, this is what our climate hubs spend all of our time thinking about and doing. My first tip would be to meet people where they are. Meet them where they're comfortable. I spend a lot of time, or at least I did before COVID, spent a lot of time at producer meetings with a trade show booth. And to be honest, everybody loves to talk about the weather. And so talking about the weather or asking producers kind of how are things going? What weather challenges have you been feeling lately is a great way to start the conversation. And almost inevitably, if you start the conversation around weather, inevitably, most producers will eventually say something like, you know, things are different than they used to be. Things are changing. Things aren't as reliable. It's their soft entry point into talking about climate, even if they're maybe not comfortable using the word climate or the phrase climate change. So meet them where they are. Listen to the language that they choose to use and echo that language. It's like traveling to another country, right? How do we approach that socially? We listen first, we learn their terminology, and we use that terminology to communicate more effectively with them. So that's my first and biggest tip. Meet them where they are. Use their language. Don't try to impose your language on them right away.
Great. Thank you, Danelle. I think those are some good starting points here. My next question, Natalia, I was wondering, what is the importance of community and fenceline neighbors working together in developing and implementing these climate resiliency efforts?
That's a great question. That's something that we've been really grappling with in California with our wildfires work. We've had some really sincere farmers who have done everything they could to reduce their risk to the wildfires as far as they can within their power. And they have been really struggling with sometimes having neighbors who are not interested at all in reducing their fuel loads and increasing defensible space. So that really creates a problem for them because then they're not able to defend. They're increasing their risk because their farmer has a higher fuel load and higher increase risk to wildfire. So we found that as much as possible, having communities be on the same page about the priorities allows for risk reduction on a regional level. And that's ultimately what's needed. Not to mention that being organized on a regional level allows for faster learning and problem solving, especially in when we have quickly changing events such as droughts and floods. But it also creates the social cohesion that we were talking about earlier. And we've tried doing that through these town hall meetings where we meet in high-risk regions, but it doesn't necessarily bring in everyone who might need to be working on those efforts. So my recommendations for bringing in the community, neighbors and community, fence line communities, is just like Elle was saying, having those conversations gently. And I think as fires in particular become more prominent and more annual or more everyday, people become used to the fires, there will be perhaps an easing up and a desire to step in and have these regional conversations and planning events.
Yeah, gosh, quite an issue of how to kind of do that community organizing and getting folks involved, but great suggestions there. Danelle, this question is going to go back to you. What is the state of the science in developing longer-term weather predictions? For example, is Washington going to get June rains this year? If you could kind of expand on that a little bit, I think that would be helpful.
Sure, Anna. And I'll preface my response by saying I'm an ag economist, so I have to be careful and stay within the limits of my own knowledge and then admit when I've reached those limits. Thankfully, my network is full of actual climate scientists who could provide the best answer to this question. But that said, a few thoughts that I can offer. One is that the science on these longer-term weather predictions, or what we might call seasonal to subseasonal forecasting, sometimes people will shorten that to S2S forecasting. That's how you'll see it referred in the popular press. That science is advancing, but it is super complex. Our climate systems and how they interact with the atmosphere are incredibly complicated. And so they involve massive amounts of computing power and modeling. So first, it's really complicated. The science is advancing, but moving that science from, a modeling exercise and a theoretical exercise to actually operationalizing it, actually putting out forecasts that the public can access and use and understand, that too is a super complicated process. And here I would kind of maybe give a plug for the importance of involving social scientists in the process of developing these longer-term forecasts to make sure that we understand what do stakeholders actually need to know or want to know? What decisions are they trying to make that they need information that far in advance? So ideally, it's not just about the state of the science. It's also about understanding stakeholders' needs, making sure we know those before we get too far down the path and create a forecast that maybe doesn't meet their needs. I think one other point is that the potential for these sub-seasonal and seasonal forecasts definitely varies depending on where you are in the U.S. The closer you are to an ocean, the more closely tied your climate patterns are to big, more predictable phenomenon like El Nino and La Nina, that, events that we can see signals pretty far in advance and can therefore connect back to what might happen in the climate of your area. But for places like Wyoming, where I live in the Northern Plains, we're pretty far from any of those oceans. So our climate is not as strongly connected to those, El Nino, La Nina, and there's several other types of what we call teleconnections. The potential for those forecasts does depend a bit on where you live. But there is a big push and a big interest right now in enhancing our seasonal to subseasonal forecasting capacities. And so our friends over at NOAA are working hard to figure out what are the next best steps to advance those types of predictions for folks.
Perfect. As a fellow ag economist, those forecasts super useful, but there does seem to be quite a bit of science and folks behind them. So I thought you took that question well. Thank you so much for your response. Natalia, we're going to go back to you. Do you have any insights or recommendations on post-event recovery while threats are still being actively addressed by farmers?
Yes, I think that is actually a critical aspect of why we do resilience planning, because the more that can be thought of ahead of time, the easier the recovery process will be. So for example, having relationships in place with agency personnel in different offices, like in the FSA office, that can provide post-recovery aid, organizations that can provide post-recovery aid, having those relationships in place can make the recovery that much easier. One thing that may seem mundane but is actually really important is having visits with insurance providers on the farm multiple times a year to see what's actually insured and what can be done to increase the likelihood that different aspects of the farm and business would be insured, and having all the paperwork in place, all the files organized and ready for it to submit a claim, because those claims take a very long time and it can be very stressful to pull together. So having that in place before an event can be very helpful. And something that farmers have shared with me multiple times, the importance of having your workforce trained. And I know one farm in Sonoma in the Northern California region that has, I think, 5 different farms in neighboring regions, and they work together to have a community-wide workforce training and practice for emergency response. So they pretend that the fire is coming or whatever urgency there is, and they practice what will happen during the event and how everyone's different roles will pan out during the event, and having that all exceedingly clear. And it might surprise you that actually having those practiced in our body can make a huge difference when it comes to responding to the event and then it being able to recover, because the recovery depends very much on how much we're impacted in our business. So those are the first ones that come to mind. Also, having backup plans and having relationships with neighbors can help a lot. And those are the few that come to mind.
Great. Thank you. It does seem as though this kind of multi drivers and multi threats coming in at the same time seem to be more and more common. So I really appreciate the insight there. We're almost coming up to the top of the hour here, so maybe we can do a quick question for each of you in closing here. So I'll go back to Danelle. What are your most popular resources? Online tools, community network events? If you could just kind of describe that quickly here.
Yep, you bet. Our most popular events are those that bring people together to learn from each other. So hands-on, peer-to-peer learning, which Natalia spent a lot of time emphasizing, and rightfully so. Those are always our most popular events that bring, you know, whether it's farmers together with other farmers or extension professionals together with other extension professionals to do some hands-on learning together and learning from each other. Those are by far our most popular events, at least in the Northern Plains. A second runner-up, though, that I want to mention, because I don't think it's come up yet, is events or trainings that help our friends in the weather and climate world learn more about agriculture. So, you know, that not only does agriculture need some help improving, you know, increasing their climate literacy, but likewise, our friends in the weather and climate world want to become more ag literate. And so those events are really mutually beneficial and enjoyable and popular.
Great. Thank you. Natalia, quick question to close us out here. What challenges have you encountered in resilience planning and resilience evaluation? That's probably a pretty loaded question, but as much detail as you could give in the time remaining, I think that would be really interesting for folks.
Yeah, sure. I'll be brief. So the first one is time. Not surprisingly, it takes a lot of time to go through the process, but we've found that just going through and writing out a plan, if you can't implement them systematically, you'll be surprised by how much you just start naturally implementing them and moving in that direction. Also, not including all the scales and dimensions that are needed in thinking about resilience. We've had examples of ecologically resilient farms that then quit and give up farming many years later because they didn't include the social and economic components to thinking about their long-term sustainability. Also, not knowing the impacts of a potential threat. This is where the science translation and scientist and producer relationships are really valuable. And finally, using this frame of climate change and climate resilience can be really off-putting. So it can be helpful to come into it gently, such as talking about extreme weather events or climate events.
Perfect. For I'm sure complex of a challenge that is. That was a very succinct response. I appreciate that. Unfortunately, we're going to have to close at this time. But I just wanted to remind you that today's webinar is one in a series covering the challenging times we face in agriculture. Other upcoming webinars will cover alternative financing sources for agriculture. This includes crowdsourcing, CSA financing, John Deere credit, and other non-bank credit sources. We'll also have another webinar on alternative crop feasibility in the face of changing climate. So stay tuned for details and dates for those webinars. We would also like to hear from you about what other topics or presentations you'd like to see offered in the future. Either send us an entry in the chat on your screen or send an email to information@farmmanagement.org. And finally, we have created a feedback survey for you. So please click the link in the chat window to access the questions and provide feedback for our Ag in Uncertain Time team. Thank you so much for your time and attention today. As mentioned earlier, the recordings and other information for this webinar will be available at the Ag in Uncertain Times website. If you are interested in a copy of any of today's presentation slides, they are also available for download. If you point your browser to aginuncertaintimes.farmmanagement.org and select the webinars tab, you'll find more information there. But let me close again by extending our thanks to today's speakers for their first-class presentations on the Climate Hub and some of their work, as well as planning agroecological resilience, and really such important work you both are doing. So I was really interested in today's presentations and really want to send a thanks there. I'd also like to thank our Ag in Uncertain Times team and their sponsoring institutions for making this series possible. We'd also like to thank all the participants in today's webinar conference and sincerely hope that you find today's content of value to your work. We hope to see you again in one of our future upcoming programs. Until then, we offer you our sincerest hope for success in meeting the challenges of today's uncertain times. For Ag in Uncertain Times, I'm Anastasia Fair. Thank you so much.